So, have you ever failed? I mean, terminally, like had to close it down, sell it off, move it out, give it up, walk away, lock the doors, turn off the lights for the last time? Well, I'm about to tell you the story of the one time that this happened to me that turned out to be final. Okay? So, saddle up. It's time for 8 second rule. This is 8 Second Rule, the podcast about attention-based marketing where we talk about getting, holding on to, and developing the attention of your ideal audience. You've got 8 seconds. What are you going to do with it? Hey, I am Mark R. Morris Jr., the bull writer of Semantic Branding. And what that means is building brands through words, copy, content, profiles, whatever you got. I can help you design it. I can help you write it. I can help you sustain it. I can build systems to help you create it. That's my gig. That's my bailiwick. That's my wheelhouse. And what do I mean by 8 second rule? Well, that's all about cowboys and how long you have to stay on top of a bull to hear that buzzer so that you can score in the rodeo. That's all about basketball teams and bringing that ball down from underneath their own basket past the half court line within 8 seconds so the referee doesn't hand the ball back over to the opposing team. It's all about the 8 seconds you have to make your marketing stick with people when they show up on your website, on your social media, on your video content, on your audio podcasts, whatever it is. You've got about that much time to make an impression and get them to invest time with you. And that's what this podcast is all about. So recently, I'm just sharing, though, my entrepreneurial journey. It has been a long and storied one. I started when I was about 25. I'm almost 50 now. So, you know, it's a quarter of a century of stuff that went on. And today I'm going to tell you about a story that involves a major failure in my life that was difficult to deal with, but I think turned out well. And here it is. You ready? Theater companies fail. That's pretty much the universal thing that all of them, with a very few exceptions, have in common. If they are meant to pay the bills, and especially salaries, they're notoriously difficult to maintain, even on Broadway, okay? So ours was no different. And I've shared this, you know, about the first time that I went under. Once we were up and running and we had our theater in place, we added a community theater to expand our offerings. And at this point, I was directing, designing, casting, and sometimes acting in 9 productions a year or more. My brilliant wife and business partner is a performer and director in her own right. We determined that if I was going to play a major role in a production, she would take on the lead role as the director. So we had a blast for the most part. And we managed to make this crank along for 7 years. We had our own building. We had our own space there. We did a lot of fun stuff, which in small for-profit theater years, that's pretty much an eternity, okay? We had looked into going for nonprofit status, but if you've ever tried this, you probably already know what I'm about to say. There's a lot of things to consider. It isn't even close to a guaranteed deal. It's not like you can just sit back and people are just going to send you checks all day long. Here's what happens. First of all, the fundraising becomes almost another full-time job. So you have to find prospects, you have to contact them and pitch them, and donations have to be collected. In-like-kind donations were counted dollar for dollar, which meant watching how money was spent to stay within the guidelines, because if somebody gave you building materials, it counted dollar for dollar as income. In the U.S., at least 30% of any 501c3's income, at least at the time that I was doing this, had to come from donations and related earned income. So tuition, ticket sales must either be collected as suggested donations or extremely limited in scope, and they can ding you for it at any point in time, and the rules are constantly changing. And as with any government situation, as you probably already know, the rules are actually whatever the referee is calling that day. So if they determine that you're in the wrong, you're at fault, and it's going to cost you, and you will be considered guilty until you prove yourself innocent. So finally, in the end, it was the bulkiness of having to make all those extra decisions by committee that killed the nonprofit process. We were much more nimble without a board to consult on every facet of what we did. We did, however, like the board for other things, so we established a volunteer advisory committee to help with promotions and other outside PR type tasks, and that was a good step. We got back up to nearly 100 students. It was going pretty good. We weren't able to do the scale of musical productions we'd done in the past, but we began to offer daytime classes for homeschooled students, summer film camps, a dance school to make use of our studio space in the evenings when we didn't have rehearsals or classes, and everything seemed to be going along pretty well. We were poised to make a really big move when the wheels fell off. And I'm sure this is the story of a lot of businesses. It was 2009. I've kind of racked my brain to understand what happened next, because I'm a big believer that you reap what you sow, and I cannot for the life of me remember stealing anyone's business. But this happened to me again. This time it was a community theater volunteer, and she had run a dinner theater in a past life. And at some point, she recruited our entire adult cast of actors to engage in running one with her while she was working with us, never having said a word to us. And when we got to our next audition, not one of them showed up because they were already in her production that I knew nothing about. And she'd offered to give all of her dinner theater plays to my studio, and we were in negotiations for me to take that on and start doing it when she did this. And then at the same time, our dance teacher claimed that she believed that we were shutting down. Nothing was further from the truth. We were in a mode of attempting to take as many students on as we could. So she took our dance studio, our students, to another studio. There were about 25 of them, owned by someone that I thought was my friend for over 20 years previous to this. She just took them without saying a word. I didn't find out until nobody showed up for class, and then she wasn't there. And I called her, and this was the story that she told me. You were shutting down, so I took them with me. We weren't shutting down. No one ever said we were shutting down. A former student and my own brother opened competing studios in markets that they felt were far enough away not to compete, but we lost students to both of them. So it was just several things. It was a triple whammy, essentially. But before all that happened, we had these big plans. We were ready for our fall semester. It had been going so good. We'd had a great summer. We designed a full-color, double-sided, glossy door hanger. My wife, in addition to having an excellent voice and great stage presence and being an amazing businesswoman, is also a gifted graphic designer. And we were certain that this would work. After all, we'd built every single class on simple paper flyers. But this was going to take us over the top. It was going to be our big break. So we recruited a crew, and we hit the streets. We had 10,000 Primo door hangers and another 1,500 that was slightly off print, but they threw them in because it was barely noticeable and the printer didn't need them. So between us and our students, we handed out every single one of them, and we went into ideal neighborhoods where we knew there were kids with moderately, you know, good income in their families, that were close enough to our studio that we thought it would be a good deal. And we tried to focus on school districts that didn't have as much art stuff going on. So we really thought this was a winner. And then we went home, like I had done when I started my construction business, to wait for calls. Well, what happened next took me completely off guard, and I will share that with you in the second segment. So we had these door hangers and we'd handed them all out. It was the end of the summer. Dance classes and camps had just wound down. We began to get messages of regret from existing students about a week after the flyer drive started. We got not one single call off of the door hangers, not one, except one person who called up to complain because the rain had hit, or her sprinkler system or whatever had plastered the door hanger to her front door and damaged the finish. I had to go and refinish her front door for free. And that was the only call I got off of all more than 11,000 of those. 4 days before the semester was to begin was when our dance teacher let us know she had a new job with my friend and was taking our 20 dance students with her. We were dead in the water. We literally didn't even have enough to pay the light bill. Forget the rent, forget the water, forget the gas, forget expenses. And that was the summer that the financial market scandal broke and people just stopped spending money. We were done. I wish I could say this part had a happy ending, okay? But it's been over 10 years and I haven't darkened the door of a theater to act or direct since. I just couldn't do it. But the cool thing was, this set the stage for me to get into my second zero startup. And it was kind of fun. There's no rest for the weary sometimes. For whatever reason, my kids continue to get hungry. Our bank continued to want the house payment. The utilities had not become charitable nonprofits. So I had to find something to do to bring in money. So I thought I'll just go back to swinging a hammer, but I quickly discovered that my carpentry work was another thing that people were not excited about spending money on. I couldn't find enough to keep us going, so I had to have another option. I found out later what the problem with this was. It was the invasion of the middlemen, and there were companies like Beacon and Porch that were setting up these websites claiming that they vetted contractors and they would find the best ones for you. And that if you trusted them, they would put you in contact with the primo people. But the truth was, the honest 100% truth was, these sites did no such thing. What they did instead was promote any contractor that would pay them. And so guys who had been earning their living off of, you know, simple Craigslist ads and things of that nature were suddenly out in the cold. I found out I was not the only one. And it was really difficult because that was my go-to. That was my throwback. That was my fallback position, was grab my tools and go get some work. At least I'll eat. At least I'll have the lights on. So not only was that the case, but almost no one was hiring. And everywhere I went, hundreds of qualified candidates had already been there. I couldn't even get a job at Home Depot with more than a decade of experience as a carpenter. I'd spent enough time online in the previous 10 years to know the potential for earning was inexhaustible, but I'd never actually attempted it. So all I needed was the right opportunity, and I made it my job to find it. So I'd studied creative writing, and finally it became useful. I pounded the digital pavement outside the content mill site looking for projects, and finally I hit a gold mine. See, I always believed that if I looked long enough, I'd discover one. And I know it got a bad rap from producing subpar content, supposedly, but demand media was exactly the ticket that I needed. For someone like me, it was a great place to be. They had more home improvement tutorials that needed writers than I could ever finish. And it paid daily, which was a huge bonus in our situation. That meant I could sit down, earn $75, get it in my PayPal account, go to the grocery store, make dinner, pay the water bill, and stay afloat. So up until that point, I had never even made a purchase online. Literally. And now I was in the position of never seeing physical money. Just like overnight, it just changed for me. I became a denizen of the web. It went into my account. I used a debit card to spend it. I'd done enough writing for the stage and other projects. It made me a solid typist, and I could crank out 8 to 10 800-word articles in a day. And at $25 a pop, that was enough to keep us alive. But it was grueling. It was tough work. I was writing to 10 to 12 hours a day, which is the equivalent of a 16-hour theatrical rehearsal. I promise you, it is every bit as difficult as marshaling kids for an entire day, actually 2 days. You know, it's just, writers will tell you, you think it's easy, but it's not. But in 16 months, I wrote over 3,600 articles. Yeah, right. It's a lot, right? So on top of what I had already done in home improvement, I was now like a mega expert in all facets of home improvement because I had gone in and researched and studied and written all of these tutorials on how to do all of the things that I didn't know how to do. And here I was sitting with an endless supply of work on demand. I could choose my own topics. There's a massive catalog that they had online. You just pick your topics. There's no limit to how many I could turn in. I was making 30 to 40 bucks an hour some days, and much better than anything else I could do with my time. So I kept at it. I spent $0 to get started, and I made money on my first day, okay? So we already had an internet connection. I already had a laptop. I'd been worried about the editorial review process because it had been a while since I'd taken, you know, grammar. They tried to make it sound like a terror inducing gauntlet whenever you went and looked at their site. It was like, oh, hardly anybody ever gets any articles through here. I was afraid my grammar would be ripped to shreds. But my first article, How to Build a Squirrel-Proof Bird Feeder, was accepted without a single edit. Right? That's pretty cool. I'm going to tell you more about my writing experience in just... So I got to where I was so good at composing these that I could write three different versions of how to install the doorknob, sharing the exact same info back to back, like in 4 hours, without ever even being dinged for plagiarizing myself. It was less than 4 hours, maybe two. Yeah, probably two. And that was $75, you know? I knew the subject matter well enough that what I did was reverse engineer what was taking all the other authors so long, which was I didn't have to go and do my research first. I would describe the process, and then I would find the references to confirm my experience when the article was done. It was much faster. Now, I did have some editors that would quibble with this because they'd find some other article that they thought was a higher authority site telling me that it was wrong and that it needed to be done this way. And then I'd show them in the International Building Code or, you know, in another site, I'd be like, okay, look, what about these six examples here? What about the work that I did last week? Because I was still doing some carpentry at the time. Not only that, but this site offered a byline too on ehow.com. And some of those pieces are still in my portfolio years later. If you go to ehow.com and you search Mark Morris, you will find dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of how-to articles on fixing just about everything in your house. It's crazy. So, what happened with that? Well, Google is notorious for taking good things away online, right? So they didn't like the eHow was so successful because if you can remember this at all, in the mid 2010 to about 2014, anywhere you went and you searched for how to do anything online, you were going to land on eHow. It was going to take you straight there because we were producing so much content. I was not the only writer that was there. There were thousands of us. Before it had been a full year and a half, they pulled the rug right out from under eHow. So we went from dozens of articles to almost nothing in a week because producing article content, you know, they had branched out and started doing it on other sites and stuff, but doing it the way they were doing it just became faux pas to the search engines. So editors started slowing down on approving work and the pay started to dwindle. And here I was, you know, a year and a half later going, well, okay. But just at that time, a good friend of mine called one day and asked a fateful question. He said, what do you know about social media consulting? Mind you, this guy was a pastor. Okay, so I knew he had been a salesman in a past life and a sales trainer for Xerox, but here he is asking me this question. It was 2010. I mean, what did anybody know about social media consulting? Not very much, but the ride that I was about to take would be my most ambitious zero startup to date. And I'm going to tell you all about that in my next episode. So, let's talk. If you are in a position to start something, okay, and you go looking for advice on how to start something, and you go to the bookstore, you go to Amazon, you go to your public library, you go to someone's bookshelf, and you look at business books on how to start businesses. Here's mostly what you're going to find: a lot of advice on tax preparation and accounting and raising investment dollars, and all of that sort of thing. What you don't find a lot of is how to formulate what a good product is and how to provide a service or a product that people are actually looking for. So the best way to start a $0 startup, guys, is to find a demand that you know you can supply, okay, without having to invest in, you know, another college degree or spend $1 million or buy a bunch of fancy equipment or buy into a franchise or any of that stuff, and just find your first customer. This is my sincere advice. Now, it's easiest if you can do this as a side gig, a side hustle, while you've got an actual job paying your bills. But if you find yourself, because of the pandemic, completely unemployed, look around. There's got to be something that somebody in your area wants that you could do. What is that? Do you know that there are people who have made millions of dollars scooping poop, walking dogs, washing windows, watering plants, feeding fish, house sitting? Simple things that almost any human being who isn't, you know, struggling with some type of learning disability or something of that nature can do. And, you know, I get it. If you live in a small town, it's going to be much tougher for you. Online is probably the way to go. But there are a ton of things that you can do online. You can sell affiliate products. You can sell books that you can write for free and publish for free and put on a website for free. All of these things could be done. You can run a podcast like this one and get sponsors. By the way, I'm going to be looking for sponsors soon. If you have a business or a product and you'd like to talk to me about sponsoring this show, please do so, because that's something that I am looking for. There's just so many things you can do, okay? Now, I know everybody wants to be a coach these days, and I'm sure everybody needs a coach, but we're not going to be able to sustain the number of coaches we've got, unfortunately, because people who, you know, just need a job, who aren't really of the coach mindset, get into the business and it ends up being a difficult situation for them and for their clients. So it's hard for them to sustain. So there are a lot of things that are popping up that may or may not be the best options. But look, there are places where you can teach courses. There's all kinds of stuff you can do online to form your own business. And most of it takes very little capital, and some of it will produce a really good, solid income if you're willing to work at it. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be easy. But guys, I've done this enough times now to prove that over a series of industries, I can pop up, show up, make money, run something, keep it going for a while. I get bored easy. So I am not the guy who would take a job and stay there for 40 years anyway. But if you're of that mindset and you're ready to start a business, you should do it. I've got a buddy who started out as a handyman, and when he started out, he didn't know anything about carpentry, and he's a better carpenter than I am now, and I've been at it for 25 years, and he's been at it for 15. But he really pushed himself to excel and to learn new skills and to get after it because it was his passion. He loves it, and he's really good at it. And in fact, I send most of the business that I hear of to him because I'm not in that business right now. You know, I'm not trying to do that right now, and I want people to have a good option. So I just want to encourage you that if you're in that place, there are things you can do. If you open your eyes and you believe in opportunity and you understand this, the universe is incredibly abundant. If you don't believe me, stop cutting your yard for a year and then come back to it and see what all lives there now. See what all grows there now. There are guys that will teach you about urban food that could show you how to go into an empty lot and feed yourself. I'm not even kidding. Off of plants that we all think are weeds that just grow along the fence row or whatever. Guys, it's not that difficult. And it's the thinking that gets us. It's that idea that we have to be inside of a vein somewhere in the system, that we have to be traveling on a track that other people recognize in order to be legit. And it's just not true. Listen, I'm rambling on and on and on. I need to probably do some talking on this subject in the future. But for now, I'm going to cut out of here and give you your free tool for the day and be done with this episode. So, as promised, the free tool for this episode is going to be SquareUp.com. It allows you to invoice clients, receive payments through credit cards. There's no upfront purchase. And in fact, they send you a free Square Reader, which you can use to scan credit cards into your smartphone. I'm not sure that that would work with my Galaxy S20 because it just has the USB-C port. It doesn't have a headphone jack. And I think that's usually how those work. So I'll have to look into that and see if that would even function. But they do give you quite a bit of support. And there's a lot of different tools that they've got. They allow you to accept donations. They allow you to sell products. They allow you to deliver products online and send invoices, like I said. So check them out. It's at squareup.com. And it's a free thing to start. They just need some basic information to confirm your identity. And then you'll be able to receive payments. What a deal. All right, guys, thanks for listening to 8-Second Rule. Don't forget, you need to be thinking now about what those 8 seconds mean and how you're going to take advantage of them before the opportunity presents itself. Have a great day.